right now in Rwanda?
We have 30 seconds. What has surprised you most about what is happening today?
Very little at this point, I'm sorry to say, surprises me. But the general indifference by the American political and intellectual elites to the relationship between the war on terror and the erosion of democracy is also a very deep thread and very historically rooted, not just in the war on terror, but before. And certainly seeing that those connections have to be made in order to have any form of real democracy in this country and safety and dignity for so many people.
Spencer Ackerman, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning national security reporter, his new book, Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Cable's fall membership drive will kick off September 15th, and our theme is the sounds of democracy. KBOO is non-commercial, independent, and community-supported radio, one of the most democratic forms of media. During the drive, we'll feature content focused on democracy throughout the radio day. On September 15th, the Old Mole Variety Hour will look at democracy through the lens of cultural work, how the arts like music, photography, theater, and fiction raise up the voices of those too often silenced by the corporate media. As a premium for KBOO donors, the Moles are offering prints of Betty Lee's photography, which document two decades of activists in the streets of Portland. For details, visit the Old Mole webpage on kboo.fm. And thanks for your support. Music by Hanto Beatmaker.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. No contracts, no snacks, say Nabisco workers on strike in five states. They don't care about frontline workers. They only care about the almighty dollar. We're tired of getting stepped on and treated like trash. We've had enough, says striking Nabisco worker Rusty Lewis.
We're joined now by three of the strikers from the Richmond, Virginia plant, Darlene Carpenter, Janelle Lambert-Watkins, and Christine Brown. Members of Local 358 of the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers Union.
We're talking to Nabisco workers on strike in five states over pensions and outsourcing. And the first question is, should I throw away my Oreos, throw away my Ritz crackers until you as workers get what you want and need?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes, you should. Absolutely.
Would we carry that through and say that we're actually telling people to boycott the company until such time as they give the workers their just due?
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, you heard it here. No more Ritz, no more Oreos until the workers are compensated as they deserve to be. So with that, why don't we go around and talk about the kind of work that you folks do for Nabisco, how long you've been working there, and what it's been like to work in the plants. Why don't we get started with, how about Christine?
I've been with Nabisco for 20 years. I'm a packing technician on the Ritz line. I package the Ritz. It's been a challenge, especially during last year, during COVID. We worked through the whole pandemic and got no compensation. All we get is a slap in the face with all this outsourcing of our jobs to Mexico, and they want to change our work schedule as if we're not working enough hours as it is, and they talk about it's for a better home-life balance. How can it be? Now you're disrupting my life balance with a 12-hour shift, when normally my shift is just 8 hours. So you're not making it better for me. You're making it worse.
Janelle, talk about the work that you do.
I'm a mixing technician, and I mix the ingredients. I've been there 13 and a half years. And the conditions are, they want you to do certain things on the job, but they don't sanitize. And through the pandemic, as Christine said, we worked through the pandemic, but no sanitation is being done. And then they want you to come in to work. Even when we have gotten cases for COVID, they still want you to work, even though you've been around people that have COVID. You can go get tested, but that's not the right way to do it. That's definitely not the right way to do it. You want to make sure your workers that are making these cookies for the consumer are protected as well. We don't want to have COVID and working, making cookies, and we are not safe, and they are not making us safe all at the same time.
How many workers are in the plant that you're both in?
Go ahead, Darlene.
436 members at the Richmond plant. It's actually a really good mixture. Probably a little bit more men than women, but for the most part, pretty good mixture. We've got people that have worked there for 45 years. Their children or spouses are working there. It used to be a really nice family affair at this plant until it started changing hands. And once it went over into Kraft and they spun off Mondelez, that's when things started going downhill for the workers in the plant.
Yes.
Now, one of the things I don't understand is this thing with the work hours and how that affects you and what exactly it means. So who wants to tell me about that?
This is Christine. I can speak on it. Right now, we have an 8-hour shift. Anything after 8 hours is either time and a half, and on Sundays is double time. They want to change that to a 12-hour shift with straight time. They saying it's for a better work-home balance. It can't be. How can it be better when you, now you're cutting my salary because now I'm working 12 hours with no overtime pay, and on top of that, you're cutting my premium pay. And if it's for a better work-life balance, you're making it worse because if you got children, how are you going to get your children on and off of the school bus or on and off school when you're working 12 hours and it's no guarantee you're going to go home after that 12 hours? You can get, and they stated, you can get forced up to 60 hours per week. So how is that a better work-life balance when now regularly we work typically 40 hours a week? Anything over that is chosen. Can choose when we want to work on Saturday and Sunday. That's a choice we make if the lines is running. But the way they want to go to it is no choice. You could be working Saturday and Sunday regardless.
And Janelle and Christine, both of you also talk about daily, what it's like to work. I mean, to get some sense of the kind of the pride that people go to work with and the blood, sweat, and tears that people like yourself have put into the Nabisco plant where you work for decades now.
It used to be a great place to work, as Darlene stated, until Mondelez took over. When it started shifting hands and Mondelez took over, you could see the morale in the plant has just gone down here. People, damn, they don't care. You know, they come to work and they do their job, but they don't care about the quality of the product like it used to be, because the management don't care. We go to them and tell them this not looking right. They tell you to run it anyway. When you tell them, no, I can't run this because my family eat this, David said, oh, you going to run this? Because I said so. The quality of the product is not the way it used to be, because their focus is getting out numbers as opposed to getting out quality product. And case in point, if you get a package of our product, for, if you can find it, made here in Richmond, and a package from Mexico, you can see the difference. We can tell that those made in Mexico, no, they don't care about it because it's crumbly. It doesn't taste as good. And look at coming from Richmond, we put out a better quality product, but it's not like it used to be.
And tell us what your job is like on a day-to-day basis, the labor, the energy that you put in. What's it like?
I go to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I live an hour and 45 minutes away. I'm happy to get up and go to work, but when Mondelez has taken over, it's like I hate to get up now, but I know I have a job to do, and I'm going to do that job regardless. But I'm not looking for no pat on the back. It's just that doing your workers some justice, and this, the thanks we get, you want to take all our benefits away, you want to pay us low pay, you want to do everything to us but the right thing. I make the ingredients, mix the ingredients up, and I love doing what I do. I rotate different lines every day and make sure the product a standard, the highest standard it could be. Now, I can't speak for everybody else in the plant, but we all try to make sure that that cookie is what the consumer wants. To piggyback off of what Janella just said, I love my job too. It's just the working conditions. They come in, want to take, but they not rewarding us for the hard work that we done put in. They got all these signs posted all around the plant talking about heroes work here, but you're not treating us like heroes. You're treating us like stray off the street just coming in, because you want to take everything from us. You want to change our work schedule. You want us to pay for insurance that we done paid for over the years by concession, by not getting raises, but yet and still, you gonna put up these banners that's supposed to make us feel better. Heroes work here. We don't feel like heroes. We feel like somebody that you don't care about, because if you treat heroes like this, that shows how you're treating everybody else.
Let's just back up for a second. You mentioned insurance. Does that mean health insurance? What's happening with health insurance?
Yes. They want to change that also. They want the new people coming in to pay for the insurance, whereas right now we don't pay for it. But technically we have paid for it, because over the years we have gave up raises so we could keep the health insurance. So we paid for it, but now they want to backtrack and want us to pay for it again. That's not fair to us. And not fair to the young people coming in either, because if they find out, oh, they got to pay for insurance that we don't have to pay for, that's a way that they want to divide us.
I want to get on board with understanding more about the downsizing. What I understand is nearly 2,000 jobs to Mexico. Tell us about that.
The company actually shut down two plants this year. In June, they shut down their Atlanta, Georgia plant. In July, they shut down their Fairlawn, New Jersey plant. That took about 1,000 workers out of work. That cut our membership as union members 50%. And the company saved $300 million by shutting that plant down. Now, we've asked the company, would they repatriotize that product to Chicago, Portland, and Richmond? And we asked what in writing, and they wouldn't do it. But yet they're telling the public, we didn't send anything overseas. Of course you did. You sent it to Mexico. They are killing the American middle class jobs. We can't compete with Mexico. They make 97 cents an hour. Did y'all hear what I said? 97 cents? That's ridiculous. That's slave labor. And I get passionate about it because it makes me angry. Not only are they treating the American workers wrong, but they're treating the Mexico workers wrong too. Mm. So our campaign right now is not to boycott all the products, but to boycott the Mexican products and start letting their American plants start producing the stuff and keeping the middle-class jobs here instead of shipping everything over there. Our people at the plant have a fear. Are we going to be the next plant that gets shut down? You know, we worked through this major pandemic, and we're still in this pandemic. And the reward that they gave our plants in New Jersey and in Georgia was to shut them down. how horrible. Shame on Nabisco for what they've done. And now we're at these crossroads with our negotiation. They want everything that we've gone to the table with, and I have been personally at these negotiations, has been a takeaway. If you guys excuse my voice, me and the bullhorn out on the picket line, I think the bullhorn won. But everything's a takeaway with the company. All they want is concessions, concessions, concessions. Like Christine was talking about, the alternative work schedule, which is a 12-hour shift, alternate days, but they can force you up to 60 hours a week. By doing that, what they're also doing is taking away our premium pay. So that's going to cost our workers anywhere from $20,000 to $40,000 a year in overtime pay. That's a major takeaway. And with our health insurance, what they want to do is a two-tier system. We have 100% health care, but we pay for this with concessions over the years. We have given up raises in order to have what we have today. So what the company has proposed, any new hires would have to pay for theirs, and we could keep what we had till the end of the new contract. We said no. We're not selling out any new employees. We are a union. We are union strong, and we're family strong. We would never do that. And I'm appalled that the company would even ask us to do something like that. But then again, it's another way of busting our union up. That really pissed me off, to say the least. Back during the pandemic, with our people working as hard as they were working, they came to us in March. They were going to give them our appreciation check for the hours that they worked for the entire year. They came to our people with a $300 check before they took taxes out. And I thought, are you kidding me? They just made $28 billion in revenues, and they gave us $300, took taxes out of that. I took that $300 and I divided it by 52. They valued their workers at $5.77 a week during a pandemic, where they were risking their own lives and risking their family and loved ones' lives. This is what we're dealing with. It gets to the point that you have to say, when is enough enough? You know, they stole our pension. Now they're trying to take everything else away from us. Corporate greed at its finest. And it's right here at Mondelez. And the people have finally came to the point that we're not going to take it anymore. So we're walking that ticket line right now, 24/7. The temperatures down here in Richmond have been in the 90s, 98, 97. I mean, it's extremely hot. But we're out there walking. We've been in torrential downpours. These people have not let up. We started this fight on the 16th of August. They are still going strong. And I give them kudos, because if that doesn't tell the world they are fighting for what they believe in, I don't know what else would.
Darlene, describe a little for us your background and relationship. You're a union leader, organizer at this point. Did you come up from the ranks, and how did you begin to take a stand and work in this plant?
I've worked at the plant for 14 years. This June, I was elected as the business agent, financial secretary for the local 358. So I just left that plant in June to take this new role on. So I've been in those trenches. I know how I was treated there. I know how my coworkers feel. We came in day in, day night. You never know if you get to go home, because an hour before your shift ends, they could be forcing you over, which they did a lot of. You're working 16-hour shifts. You're tired. You're scared. You don't know if you're going to be the next one to get sick. But the work itself is very physical, demanding work. We're standing on concrete floors. That wears on you. And then the morale in the plant has been horrible. Ever since the company took the pensions, such low morale, to the point that you got up in the morning and you were pulling into that parking lot, you felt the tension. I mean, you could cut it with a knife. It was that thick. You just didn't want to be there. No one should have to work like that.
And Janelle and Christine, you're out on the picket lines in this hot weather. What kind of support are you getting from the community?
It's outpouring support. We get donations daily. They come out and help us picket on the lines. I mean, just a whole lot of support, mental support. And they're sometimes they're 24 hours with us, supporting us.
Yes, the community has been great. We've even had people come from out of town bringing Gatorade, water, ice,
just to say we with you, we support you. The support is great, and yes, it's hot. It is hot. We've been out there, but we make sure we keep something to drink. We keep hydrated. We out there, we fighting for our livelihood, because if we give the company what they want, then they go keep on taking till we have nothing. But the community have really stepped up. People that we thought wouldn't, they really come through, and they really stepping up for us. So I got to give kudos to the community.
And we're talking about more than 1,000 workers who are on strike at Nabisco's U.S. bakeries and distribution centers. Workers on strike represent Nabisco's only remaining U.S. bakeries in Portland, Oregon, Chicago, Illinois, and Richmond, Virginia. Nabisco workers at the company's distribution centers in Aurora, Colorado, and Norcross, Georgia, are also on strike. Talk to us more about this whole issue of transitioning, or the stealing, the theft of jobs, how and when that began to happen, and sending them down to Mexico, the change in the company with the new ownership. I mean, talk to us about that process and how infuriating that must be. You know, tell us more about the greed and the profit drive, and how are we to understand this new company that came in when, frankly, Nabisco was doing quite darn well to begin with, profit-wise?
Well, I mean, when they do things, they tell us about it afterwards. They don't outright let us know. It's afterwards. And then we find out about it when they send out a memo, and then you hear about it later. It's been something with this company. Only thing they want to do to us is send our jobs to Mexico. On top of that, these new lines that they bring in, you're not being trained correctly. As far as the transition, there's basically no transition. There's more of a, they're going to do it, and we find out about it later. The workers are always the last to know anything. Always.
But we're the ones putting in all the hard work. And if something go wrong, they come running to us, want us to tell them how to do this, how to do that. But you're not telling us, oh, look, we getting ready to sell y'all to Mondelez, and we sending X amount of jobs to Mexico. They're not telling us anything. Like Janella said, we're the last ones to know anything, but we putting in the hard work. And the training is awful. And they preach safety. They don't care whether we safe or not. They showed us on that during the pandemic. Because if they cared about us, they would have brought in professionally trained cleaners when this COVID first hit to sanitize and clean that whole plant. They did it after the fact. And they still don't have no set protocol as to how they cleaning, what people supposed to do if they found out they get it or whatever. Yeah, they got a little thing in writing. You do this if you found out you tested, but every time a case come up, then they change what they got in place. How are we supposed to feel like we safe and we care about what we're doing if you're not doing it yourself? Because, see, they don't care. They set up in the front office behind the desk all day. They don't come out on that packing floor and see how hard we work or what we're going through. During that whole pandemic, we might have seen a supervisor once per day, and on payday for them to hand out our paycheck. They ain't come out around us, but then cases popped up in the plant. It wasn't among the supervisors. It was among the workers, because they are not sanitizing like they should.
Just to bring up a point, over the last 7 years, Nabisco has closed 3 of our plants. They downsized some other ones, and they shipped 2,000 good middle-class jobs to Mexico. Right now, they're threatened to ship more jobs to Mexico if we, as a union, don't agree to their demands for their major concessions in this new contract. They're making record profits. Tell us something about who these CEOs are and their profit rate. Oh, he's making billions. This guy is Dirk Vanderput. He has just taken, I think he just took a bonus. I don't want to quote the wrong figure, but it was like $13 million in the bonus that he just took. they're not hurting for money. Let me tell you, it's just apparently they don't have enough in their pocket as it is. They want to take everything else from us. He works under the European schedules as far as how they treat their people. Americans aren't going to put up with that. Enough is enough. But this guy, I'm not for sure where he lives at. I wish I kind of knew, but I don't. Maybe it's a good thing I don't. But, you know, just the money that this guy is making and the concessions they're asking for, you know, and us asking for them to put a commitment in writing that they're going to keep the jobs here in America, and they won't do that. That gives you a real uneasy feeling. What is their game plan? 10 years down the road, are we going to have any American plants producing it? Was everything going overseas for the slave labor?
But I'm also interested in, Ken asked you about the community support. You said the community's really united. I'm interested, yeah, though, in two things. What this means for the community to have all these folks out, and whether or not the local politicos, whether your politicians are weighing in on this as well.
Yeah, our politicians have been coming out, given their support, given speeches. They've actually donated. We have a GoFundMe fund. They've actually donated to that. They're talking to other politicians. The community, they've been awesome. Coming out, bringing ice and water. You know, they've walked the lines with us. Our community is a very close-knit community. A lot of us that work in that plant live in this community. If this plant was to go under, that would kill this community. We support the community by going to the grocery stores, and not just the grocery stores. We do all of our local shopping and stuff, and it's hurting the community right now because we don't have the money to be out there supporting them right now because we're not getting a paycheck. So would it devastate the community? I think yes, would, in a whole lot of different ways. You know, the housing industry, everything would fall apart. You'd have people losing their homes, foreclosures. Everything's affected. It's a trickle-down effect.
And do you know this to be the case also in the other plants, too? Because as we said, we're talking about five cities where Nabisco workers are on strike. So what's the communication there? And is it the same kind of close-knit family of workers and with the same kind of effects in really destroying small communities where these plants are the center fold of the workforce?
Absolutely it is. I've been keeping in touch with Portland. Cameron Taylor is their business agent out there. Their community is behind them 100%, and they're overwhelmed with the support they're getting in a good way. I've talked to Veronica Hopkins up in Chicago. You know, Chicago, they lost 600 jobs to Mexico several years back. Now, this is another hard hit for them. And yes, it is affecting them extremely hard. They're getting a lot of support. I would have to say the solidarity for all three of our plants that are still here in the United States has been overwhelming. It's been awesome. And then the other unions that are stepping up now and coming out to help us. We've had the United Food and Commercial Workers out there. We've had the teacher unions. We've had the Teamsters. We've had the IBUs. We've had CWA, Industrial Workers of the World. I mean, they're all behind us and supporting us. And this is something that I don't think a lot of people realize, but this is a historic thing that's happening right now. This plant has never been on strike here in Richmond. The last strike was 52 years ago in Chicago. We are trying to set a precedent that American workers will not take this anymore. Corporate greed has got to stop.
And so lastly, how do our listeners help you? Boycott Nabisco, and what else? Who do they send letters to? Who do they send messages to? What do they do to help you financially?
If they want to do a financial support, I know that Richmond and Portland both have GoFundMe accounts that they're online. So we got this. And then with, I'm not for sure if Chicago has it yet or not, but they could always write a check to their local, which is local number one in Chicago, CCTGM, local number one, to help those guys out. For financial support, that'd be awesome. If they want to start writing letters to our CEO at Mondelez, I encourage that. You know, if you're near anywhere where these strikes are going on, please go out and support these people. After we've been up there 24/7, we're tired. We need that boost. We need to know that people are behind us. That support means a lot to us. So those are different things that they can do to help us. We're not asking them to boycott all the Visco products. We're asking them to boycott anything made in Mexico. And it will show it on the label. It'll say made in Mexico, or it will say MM or MS. They have two state-of-the-art plants down there. If they could boycott that, that would be a tremendous help to us.
Darlene Carpenter, Janelle Lambert Watkins, Christine Brown, Nabisco Strikers from the Richmond, Virginia plant stay strong and will boycott those Nabisco snacks made in Mexico until you all receive a fair contract. This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Today on Wings, the power of Black women's organizing in the U.S. labor movement.
We're winning. We're winning.
Stay tuned.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Today we celebrate Black women labor leaders. I'm Kate Raphael. The other day, I dropped in on a Twitter town hall on Black workers. I had never been to a Twitter town hall before, and I'm still not sure I know exactly what it is. But one of the things I learned there is that Black women are the most receptive to union organizing of any group of workers in the U.S., and campaigns with Black women leaders are most likely to succeed. These findings came from a report by the Black Worker Initiative of the Institute for Policy Studies called And Still I Rise, and I will speak with one of the women leaders profiled in that report, Robin Williams. Don't go away.
You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I'll rise.
And Still I Rise, Black Women Labor Leaders, Voices, Power, and Promise, is a report created by researchers Kimberly Freeman Brown and Mark Bayard for the Black Worker Initiative, which is a project of the Institute for Policy Studies. Over 400 women responded to a survey, but the researchers also interviewed 27 women leaders. Robin Williams is one of them. I imagine that was an interesting name to be growing up with, Robin.
Absolutely.
But she's not Robin Williams, the comedian back from the grave. She is the Associate Director of Civil Rights and Community Action for United Food and Commercial Workers International Union based in Washington, D.C. Robin, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much, Kate. When I was interviewed for this report, I was the Associate Director of Civil Rights for the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. But since then, I became the Director of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Civil Rights Department and International Vice President. So I have.
You have been promoted, so great. Congratulations.
Yes, and to another level of leadership since this report.
Well, what do you think significant about doing a study like this?
I think that the report really tells what we've already know, right? That Black women are leaders. It also tells a story about how Black women love their union. That women that are in unions, we understand the power of unions. We understand the power of unity and numbers. And the report also shows that Black women are more likely to organize into unions, and Black women are good union organizers. Black women want to lead, right? Not because we have a big ego, but we want to make sure that our voices are heard. But Black women also speak for, I think, for working families, right? We are head of households, you know, more often than white women. We raise our children, but we also support our brothers as well. So the report interviewed working Black women, but also Black women that are already in the labor movement. It told stories, right? Real stories of our struggles and our success, and also what we want to do, right? What we want to do moving forward.
Great. So can you talk about your own history, how you came into the labor movement?
I had my son when I was 18, and I'm a daughter of a preacher. We grew up, you know, with strict Black religious values. So after I had my son, I was in school, but I also wanted to work because I didn't want my parents to be left with taking care of my son. I was fortunate enough to get a job for the federal government for a while, but I also worked for Safeway grocery store. And working for Safeway, I realized I had a union, and it was the union actually my father was in when he was working. And my union representative would come in the store, and I thought he had a lot of power, right, to create change. And so I was just really intrigued about the power of a union. So I got involved in the union. And I was asked to be a shop steward. So I was a shop steward for Safeway employees. And we was a close, you know, knit group. After about 5 years, my union asked me to come out and help to organize. So I would come out on leave and help organize. In 1997, my union, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, was organizing a nursing home in Southern Maryland. And the union organizers had gotten to a point where they could not gather any more support for the organizing campaign. It was a veterans home in St. Mary's County, Maryland, and a lot of the white nurses had signed up on union cards, and they were active in the campaign. But the majority of the nurses and the nursing assistants were Black women. So I was asked for my union to come out and to help, you know, go and talk to these women about joining the union. And I did. We had access to the break room and the grounds where they would come outside and smoke cigarettes or come outside and have lunch. And I started, you know, talking to women, both Black and white women, about just issues around having enough health care for themselves and what the company was providing for health care, the wages, time home with your own children, but also nurses and nursing assistants, they really care for their patients. So I was able to relate to these women because we basically talked about women issues. So we won that campaign 2 days before Christmas in 1997. And after that, I was hired as an organizer. And then I became a lead organizer for my local union. And I really loved organizing. And so I went on to organize more healthcare workers and training union organizers. And after a few years, my local union president asked me to be a union representative. So I had about 2,500 people in my unit, grocery store workers, healthcare workers, and I had one meatpacking plant. And so I represented our members, and I enjoyed doing that because I worked in Safeway for 13 years, so I knew a union contract, and I really enjoyed that. And then in 2005, I was asked to come work for my international union. And I've been at the United Food and Commercial Workers Union since 2005. There, we had a big organizing campaign at Smithfield Meatpacking Plant in North Carolina. It was a 16-year campaign, and we won that campaign soundly in 2008. With the help of community leaders throughout the country. And these workers just you know, were really great in coming together and organizing. And I do a lot of work. Some people know me as, you know, always beating up on Walmart. We've done a lot of work across the country around Walmart. But I always do my work because I'm in civil rights. I try to do my work through a racial, social, and economic justice lens. Because it's not just about getting more members to become dues-paying union members. It's really about helping all of us to become more empowered in the workplace, in the political arena, socially and economically. So that's what I really enjoy. That's the kind of short version of how I got involved in this work. And I think it's very similar for me to growing up in the church. You know, we always supported each other. And my father was a Christian minister, but he preached about self and community empowerment as well. He helped to integrate a lot of businesses in North Carolina, Ronald Rapids, North Carolina, which is his home. I have a sister that's gay. In the 60s and 70s, being in a black family, my father being one of those old-fashioned apostolic ministers, my parents loved my gay black sister as much as they loved any of us.
One movement that your union has been very instrumental in initiating and sustaining is the Fight for 15. I have seen a lot of leadership of black women on the street, and there's also been a lot of crossover, I think, between that movement and Black Lives Matter initiatives as well as immigrant justice.
Black Lives Matter, these women started Black Lives Matter, which are out of the labor movement, right? When they started, you know, especially, you know, white labor leaders, they're kind of puzzled. But their endurance and never giving up has really opened up a whole opportunity of building relationship. And their platform always involves labor, living wages, you know, the right to collectively bargain, right? The right to a union. And so they're just so amazing.
Is the Fight for 15 something that you've been involved in as in your work as civil rights director?
Yes. The $15 an hour campaign started out of SEIU and the service workers, but it was very close to our Making Change for Walmart campaign. We've been exposing Walmart for many years, and we had strikes over the years, and we had Black Friday actions, and we still have female workers that are discriminated against because of their pregnancy and, you know, and being fired. So I think the Walmart campaign and the Fight for 15 campaign, the fast food workers campaign, these campaigns have allowed all of labor, right? Not just one union to be involved. Those movements have brought us together as one movement. I am on the board of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, which is a organization of black labor leaders, and we support the Fight for 15. We just had a big action in Baltimore just today. So, yeah, I love when workers come out to take ownership of their own plight. As when people take ownership of their, you know, organizing, it's powerful. It changes everything.
My guest is Robin Williams, Civil Rights Director for the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, and we're discussing the recent report, And Still I Rise, Black Women Labor Leaders' Voices, Power, and Promise from the Black Worker Initiative. You know, so much of my experience in social justice movements has been about what a long haul it can be and, mm-hmm. you know, how slow change is. Yeah. And yet, $15 an hour, when people started talking about it not that long ago, even the people who were talking about it said, well, it's aspirational. You know, mm-hmm. we talk about 15 so that we can really get 12.
Right.
And yet now city after city, state after state are making $15 the minimum wage.
Yes.
And, you know, so maybe not on a national level, but really I think it's been so inspiring to see what grassroots organizing can really achieve.
Yes. when you don't give up, when it's just not like a phase, right? Because that's what they think, mm-hmm. right? Oh, this is going to go away. You know, that's what they thought, you know, when Michael Brown's death. Oh, Black Lives Matter, it'll go away, right?
Yeah.
Oh, this fight for 15, it'll go away. You know, organizing in Smithfield, 16 years, oh, sooner or later, it's too hard, right? But when you have that endurance, and you know, at one time, even union organizing, if organizers could not get a campaign started and they weren't getting, you know, people to be supportive of the union campaign fast enough, they would cut that campaign and just say, let's go on to something else. But now, they're seeing that we got to create these movements that's everlasting. You know, once we win the $15 now, which we are winning, right? Like you said, then we build on it, right? We build on it. Not only are we winning $15 an hour, but we also winning paid sick leave in areas, paid family leave, all these now policies that workers and communities are trying to move on, right? We're winning.
What do you think makes the difference? You know, you said the labor movement used to sort of cut and run, and now they're realizing that that's not the way to do it. You know, what do you think has changed, has led to that change?
I think we got new energy. I think we have new ideas. I think every time we win something big, like, you know, the Smithfield campaign, then it sets the stage of saying, we got to stay in this, right? And I think that the workers won't let you go. Well, imagine if we walk away from Fight for 15 right now. Really? No union's going to do that, because I tell you, people remember. We have new activists now. Workers are fighting. You know, fighting and doing these one day strike and going back to work. I think that we have more unity and communities, ministers and rabbis standing up with these workers. When the Fight for 15 workers, when they do these 1 and 2 day strikes, when they go back to work, most times a community leader walks them back to work to make sure that they get back in there. You know, I just think it's a combination. Workers won't let us stop. We got new energy. We know we got to change the strategy if we want to grow the labor movement.
One of the things that I learned from this report is that Black women have the highest rates of unionization, or of approving unions, of any group of workers in the U.S., and campaigns with Black women leaders are the most successful. And mm-hmm. yet the original question that the report seeks to address is, why has the organizing success of Black women not resulted in more Black women in leadership positions and helping to shape the direction of the labor movement? I assume part of that is racism and sexism within the labor movement. How have you experienced that, and, you know, how have you been able to confront or counter it?
Yeah, so... That's pretty challenging, and I'm sure probably a high percentage of all women, white women included, and Latino women that's in the labor movement, I'm sure have experienced sexism in some way. But Black women and Latino women, other women of color, we experience that double whammy. It's hard because we love our union. We love our union. And we want to make a difference. And a lot of times it make you want to give up. And I have experienced racism. I have experienced not your time yet, or I can start a campaign or have an idea. Once that come out of your mouth, it's somebody else's. And they have it, and they write it up, and they get a budget for it. And guess what? They get a staff. And you don't have all of that, right? Or you win something, but you don't get credit for it. If myself as a Black woman in the labor movement, if I had let those things tear me apart and I walk away, and I've been offered other positions, then I wouldn't be where I am today, still trying to make sure that the voice of Black women, Black men, but all workers are heard, and that there's, you know, a different perspective, because right now, you know, we're working on criminal justice reform in a way that we're doing restorative rights for those that were informally incarcerated. I've been blessed to have a president, international president, Mark Perrone, that believes in that. So that's first, right? But we've worked and tried to push campaigns that we don't get support from leadership. And that's the hard part, where we have worked as organizers and we have brought people into our unions, and then we still are at the bottom of the list. When I was a union organizer, I was training people to become organizers, and they would go into another department before me. And after doing that for about a year or two, I went to my president and said, hey, wait, I'm training them to be organizers, and then you put them in another department. And he said, Robin, if I take you out of organizing, no one would be organizing. Well, how fair is that to me, right? But we experience this, and we still experience it, because, you know, although we work for unions, not every a white man, a white woman, or black guy are going to treat us as equal in this movement. So I always weigh the situation. Do I walk away? If I walk away, what do my people have to gain or lose? I don't want to have a job where I'm just getting a paycheck. If I'm not making a difference, I don't want to be there. So I say it's always push. You push a little bit, and then you sit back, you know, because we as black women, you know, they already say, you know, we bitter, we this, we that. But I go to work every day, and I have a smile on my face, and there can be pain, but I'm one that I don't easily give up.
And
I hope that was okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I assume that you know some of these other women leaders who are profiled in this report, and you support each other.
Absolutely. I do know most of these women, and they interviewed 26 of us, but of course there are many more of us. Let me start with Petey Talley from Ohio, and she's featured in the report. Petey is the secretary treasurer of the Ohio State AFL-CIO. Petey's been in the labor movement for many years, and Petey is a sister mentor to me. I worked in Ohio in 2008. My union, we were part of Change to Win at that time, and I was one of the leads for the Obama campaign. And I learned so much from Petey Talley. Ohio, we won big in Ohio. And after the campaign, Ohio was hit for the first time with Right to Work. And Petey, being a leader at the AFL-CIO, when labor run campaigns like fighting Right to Work, they don't always think about us, the black community, as being partners. Or they don't do literature that address the black community. But Right to Work was written to keep black workers out of the same workforce with white workers. That's why Right to Work was written.
Interesting. But I didn't know that.
Yes, absolutely. And right to work laws affect black workers more than any other segment of workers. So Petey Talley, who again is featured in this report, Petey did something very unique. Petey works with an organization that she created called the Unity Campaign. And this Unity Campaign is an organization of all the black organizations in Ohio. So that includes labor unions, the NAACP, the Urban League, churches, black churches. So what she did, and I worked with Petey, Petey got the numbers and the data and had a report about if the state of Ohio went right to work, that means take the protections from public sector employees, how would that affect black workers in the state of Ohio? And so the numbers were like astonishing. I was surprised. Petey started having meetings with leaders in the Black community, and we started organizing against Right to Work. Now, then she had the elected officials, Black elected officials, where she was really teaching them what Right to Work would do to Black workers. And so that was really great in helping to defeat Right to Work in Ohio. Rachel Bryan is another leader that's featured in the report, and Rachel is from California. And what's so unique about Rachel? Rachel is a young woman. She works in the Civil Rights Department of the IBEW, the Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Rachel come out of the criminal justice system, and while she was in the system, she went through an apprenticeship program to become an electrician. Then we have Dr. Toni Lewis. She's actually a doctor, and she is one of the vice presidents for SEIU, and she does yoga. So she really, when I get anxious, she helps me to come back to balance. And if I could just mention Dr. Loretta Johnson also from the American Federation of Teachers, who has also over the years been a mentor to me. These women that I named, they're from other unions, but we are all a part of one family. What's so good about a sister is that, you know, they tell you the truth, right? Whether it's something you want to hear or don't want to hear. But without my sister mentors, I probably would have lost my mind by now, right? Because this work is hard. You're discriminated against a lot, or put down a lot, or, you know, your ideas are stolen from you. But without these sisters that we can rely on, we can call, and I can call one of these sisters, and I can tell them things that I know is not going anywhere other than with them. And then the response I get, I know it's going to be love.
I was raised to support unionization and unions, but I've never personally had the opportunity to be in one because I do office work in the legal industry, and it's just not organized at all. And I mean, actually, our one attempt was met with skepticism on the part of the unions because they just felt like, hey, these are the firms that fight us, you know, that try to kill our efforts. They're never going to let us organize their workers. I think that, you know, most of my listeners probably have not had the opportunity to be in unions because only something like 11% of workers are in unions in the country, and only 6% of workers in the private sector at this point.
Right.
So what can people who might be listening, who may not be Black women and may not be part of the organized labor movement, you know, what can we do to help achieve the goals of And Still I Rise, which is to get more Black women into leadership positions in the labor movement?
Well, I think you doing this interview, I think it's helpful. I know this report was helpful. When you talk about our work, it lifts us up. It really lifts us up into these leadership positions. You know, just say our names.
You know, I love that you said say our names, because say their names, say her name, you know, has been a cry that we associate with the Black Lives Matter movement. But typically we mean women who've been killed by the police or women who are incarcerated. And I think one of the great things that this report does is present a picture of Black women who are coming into power, who are taking power, who have their struggles, but defy the image of Black women as only victims of severe oppression. And so, you know, read this report, enjoy these portraits of women who are doing incredible things, and as Robin Williams has said, say their names. Tell people, tell other people about the incredible women that you're reading about. And this is something every one of us can do. AndStillIRise.org, that's and Still I Rise with dashes in between the words. And stillirise.org is where you can download and read this entire inspiring and informative and interesting report by the Black Worker Initiative and the Institute for Policy Studies. Robin Williams has been my guest. She is the Civil Rights Director for the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union based in Washington, D.C. Robin, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Kate Raphael and KPFA Women's Magazine, for sharing this interview. Find more episodes of Women's Magazine at kpfa.org. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. And please like our news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose newest book is called The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
KABU members, it's time once again to vote and make your voices heard. KABU's 2021 annual membership meeting and board election is coming up on Sunday, September 26th from 1 to 3 p.m., live streaming from the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. KABU members are invited to participate in a lively discussion on how to reconnect KABU's diverse communities after 18 months of the pandemic, the role of radio in the 21st century, and the upcoming celebration of our 54th anniversary. KABU depends on its members to help shape its operations and programming. So show your support by casting your vote and joining this community forum. Be sure to check your mailbox for your ballot and voting information. If you don't receive your ballot in the mail by September 13th, please contact the membership department or vote online at kabu.fm. Ballots cast by mail must be received by Friday, September 24th. The deadline to vote electronically